Tactopia. Tactopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Ugeavisen Ingeniøren, med støtte fra Innovation Center Danmark, Messecenter Herning og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tactopia. I sidste uge der stod cheferne for Google, Facebook og Twitter skoleret for de amerikanske politikere. Det er ikke første gang, det sker, og alle vi andre også med årene blev mere opmærksomme på de såkaldte tech-giganters magt og på begreber som datakapitalisme. Internettet og dem, som bygger services og platforme på nettet, er gået fra at være noget, som er en positiv ting, til at være noget, vi i stigende grad er kritiske overfor. Sådan har det ikke altid været, og måske så kan vi faktisk også lave om på det igen. Og i den her udgave af Tectopia, der kan du møde en af de idealister, der arbejder på at skabe et nyt og frit internet. Lidt ligesom det, vi havde i gamle dage, før verden gik at lave med tech-giganter og datakapitalisme. Tactopia. Regeringer i den industrielle verden, i trætte giganter af kød og stål. Jeg kommer fra cyberspace, sindets nye hjem. På vegne af fremtiden, så beder jeg jer for fortiden om at lade os være i fred. I har ingen rettigheder her, hvor vi samles. John Perry Barlow, han skrev disse indledende ord til sit cybermanifest om det frie, uafhængige internet, A Declaration of the Independence of Cyberspace, en nat på World Economic Forum i Davos i 1996, som et svar på verdensledernes digitale uvidenhed og som en protest mod daværende præsident Bill Clintons Communications Decency Act, der skulle regulere pornografisk materiale på nettet, men ifølge Barlow ville den indskrænke al ytringsfrihed på nettet. John Perry Barlow har været medstifter af den elektroniske borgerrettighedsbevægelse Electronic Frontier Foundation og dermed konsekvent fortaler for ytringsfrihed på nettet. Hans projekt handlede i høj grad om, at vi skulle genopfinde os selv i en ny virtuel verden uden regeringskontrol og nationale grænser. Da Barlow har skrevet sit manifest, var .com-bølgen ved at rulle i gang. Amazon var stiftet 2 år tidligere. Apple var i krise, men Steve Jobs er vendt tilbage i slutningen af året. Og i dag ved vi jo godt, hvad det betød for selskabets succes. Larry Page og Sergey Brin stiftede Google i en garage, og Mark Zuckerberg, ja, han var bare 12 år gammel. Da dot-com-boblen dem var brast, ja, så kunne Google alderen starte. World Wide Web viste sig at være et fremragende værktøj til at skalere national startup til global dominans. Facebook fulgte i hælene på Google, og da Amazon fandt ud af at gøre abonnement på datakraft i skyen til en forretning, ja, så bevægede firmaet sig også med raketfart til global dominans. I kølvandet på dot-com-crashet ved årtusindskiftet, der lignede Web 2.0 og bloggerkulturen ellers en social medierevolution, der ville bære Barlows frihedsidealer frem. Men i takt med at Google, Facebook og Twitter, de satte sig på social media og voksede sig stærke på annoncemarkedet, gennem at tage markedsandele fra de traditionelle annoncefinansierede medier, ja, så forekom Barlows manifest en smule bedaget, ja, nærmest fjollet. Amazon gik i gang med at smadre grundlaget for fysiske bogbutikker og vendte sig ret hurtigt mod alle mulige andre brancher. Apple satte musikdownloads i systemet og opfandt appen, som blev et lukket system ligesom fortidens CD-ROM, hvor man har fuld kontrol med indhold, betaling og distribution i App Store'en. Det var i sandhed fjern fra et frit og åbent internet, hvor alle kunne smække en hjemmeside op. Det er der ingen, der gør mere, fordi alle bruger Facebook og Twitter, og de tjenester, som er fulgt efter, fordi Apples smartphone har defineret en ny måde at bruge nettet på. Her til morgen kunne man i magasinet The Economist læse, hvordan de amerikanske tech-giganter de surfer på pandemiens bølger. Tredje kvartal for Amazon er så godt, at de vokser med 37% til mere end 96 milliarder dollars i omsætning. Det betyder, at de hyrer 50% flere ansatte til at klare efterspørgselen for alle de husstande, der er lukket ned på grund af corona. Alphabet, som er moderselskabet for Google, ja, deres aktier steg, fordi Googles annoncesalg, det fik det bedre, især på YouTube. Apple solgte færre iPhones, end man egentlig havde ventet, men men overordnet set så fastholdt de både deres omsætning og deres indtjening. Og trods en omfattende og stigende kritik af Facebook, ja, så havde de et fantastisk kvartal med en vækst på 22% i omsætning. Så Barlows industrigiganter, det var ikke de gamle og de trætte, det var de nye og friske startups på væksthormon, og de slog hans drøm ihjel, selvom de på overfladen hyldede den. Men der findes stadig folk derude, som tror på den gamle drøm om et frit og åbent internet. En af dem er Dominic Williams fra Definity Foundation i Schweiz. Han vil rykke internettet ud af tech-giganternes kvælertag gennem noget, han kalder en internetcomputer.
So the internet computer is an extension of the internet. So today, the internet just provides connectivity. And tomorrow, the internet will also be able to host and run software. So you'll be able to build websites, enterprise IT systems, and internet services directly on the internet itself, without needing servers or cloud services.
And to understand that correctly, how does that work if you don't host it anywhere?
So the internet, the modern internet, was created on the 1st of January 1983 through an open protocol that combines private networks into a single global public network, an internet work. And today we don't think about how it works, but it's a marvel of technology created by an open protocol that combines all these different private networks into a public network. And this open public network is it's permission open and permissionless, and it gave rise to all of the innovation and creativity and entrepreneurialism and economic growth that we see today. The internet computer is also created by an open protocol. The internet's created by IP, internet protocol. The internet computer is created by ICP, internet computer protocol. And it combines compute capacity from independent data centers around the world to create the internet computer.
And an independent data center, what would that be? I mean, it's a data center which is not owned by, for instance, Google or...
Yes, typically. So it would be something like a colocation facility that an ISP might run, or an independent colocation facility. And the internet computer, just like the internet, depends upon there being many different participants for its resilience and security. So we don't want the nodes, the sort of special node computers that lend their compute capacity to the internet computer, to be running in hyperscale data centers run by the likes of Amazon. It doesn't work very well with a protocol.
So is this like a peer-to-peer system, or?
There are elements of a peer-to-peer system inside. It leans more towards the traditional internet model. The internet computer actually has an onboard governance system, and a data center needs to get an ID to participate. And once they have an ID, they can start connecting machines, and the protocol incorporates the compute capacity of those machines as it needs more capacity because of increasing demand.
And since you're based in Switzerland, Zurich, I mean, is this part of some sort of blockchain or?
You can't really call the internet computer a blockchain. I mean, it has elements of the technology. It does use, the protocol depends on, for example, cryptography. But it's a sort of much broader project. And we have research centers in Zurich, two in Silicon Valley, one in San Francisco, and one in Palo Alto. And we have two other teams, one in sort of Germany primarily, remotely, and another one in a small office in Tokyo. So we're more than 100 people, and we've managed to hire some of the world's best research scientists and software engineers, many of whom are interested by the technology, but also just by the aims of the internet computer and how it will change the world. So in the future, people won't have to be captive customers of big tech and the legacy IT stack. They'll be able to build directly on the internet. So if you want to create a website, or you want to create an enterprise IT system, or you want to create an internet service, you'll be able to build it directly on the internet. So we think, in the future, the the developers of tomorrow will just write code and push it onto the internet.
But you say that it's completely open, no one will own it. So what is the role of Dfinity?
Well, Dfinity is a not-for-profit foundation, and Swiss foundations have a purpose that's defined in a notarial deed. And the purpose of the Dfinity Foundation is to develop the protocol, the Internet Computer Protocol, supporting technology, and encourage adoption of the protocol through support for the Internet Computer Network. And the foundation itself, can't be sold, can't pivot, can't change course. It just develops ICP protocol and supporting technologies and promotes the network.
So what is the vision? It's an open network, which is, open to everyone to work on and to use.
Well, the internet was open and permissionless, and that's why it succeeded when private networks like America Online and CompuServe and failed in the 1990s. And actually, people may remember that back in the 1990s, Microsoft proposed something called the Information Superhighway. And in the end, the internet triumphed very easily because it was an open protocol. So all of these individual players around the world could build out its scale. I myself had many friends who created internet service providers. And because the network, the public network that was created, was open and permissionless, it provided a much better platform for entrepreneurialism and innovation. So for example, I remember somebody created a dating service and they did a deal with America Online that it could be on the homepage. But in the end, America Online decided they wanted to create their own service, and the separate organization had a problem. The difference is, Henrik, imagine you and I were in the 1990s and we wanted to create competing dating services. Well, I couldn't call up the owner of the internet and say, hey, can you slow down Henrik's service, right? If you slow down Henrik's service, I'll give you some stock in my company or something like that. That was why the internet succeeded. It was open and permissionless, and it supported, as a consequence, all of this innovation and growth. Nobody owned it. Now, the problem today is that increasingly we depend upon user relationships and data that are owned and held by big tech. And they use these user relationships and data to create monopolies. And the monopolies actually are consolidating, so it's becoming ever more monopolistic. And that's actually antithetical to the original aims of the internet. So today it's very difficult to build new services and innovate. So for example, one of the early harbingers of where we are today occurred in 2012. There was a social games company called Zynga in Silicon Valley. It published this famous game called Farmville. And it was very successful, and it IPO'd, and it was worth $15 billion. But it published most of its games on Facebook. And then one day, Facebook decided they wanted a bigger slice of the pie, and they changed the rules. Within 3 months, Zynga lost 85% of its value. Okay, so more recently, for example, LinkedIn, which is a network of professional profiles, and I know in Germany people use this thing called Zing, but the far bigger service is LinkedIn. And
a lot of Danes use LinkedIn.
Okay, yeah. And, LinkedIn, was created by a guy called Reid Hoffman in Silicon Valley, and he was able to use venture capital to quickly grow and basically hijack everyone's professional profiles. Now, while he was growing, he provided APIs, and this was part of something called the programmable web. And he said, look, to other people, it's okay, the professional profiles can be stored here. It's like a database, and you can pull them out and use them in your own innovative services. And thousands of startups built on top of these APIs and incorporated the professional profiles into their own services. One day, of course, eventually Microsoft bought LinkedIn for a lot of money. And they weren't buying the technology, because LinkedIn's not a great website, let's be honest. It hasn't really changed much in decades. But they were buying the monopolistic position it had through the network effects of owning everyone's professional profiles. Anyways, Microsoft took a different view and they revoked everybody's APIs. And a lot of startups just went to the wall, their services stopped working. The bigger ones, some of them sold themselves to organizations like Salesforce, who managed to keep their API access. So this is something called platform risk. And it makes it very difficult to build new services because nobody wants to invest, because you might appear successful and you might be successful for a while and you might be building something that's valuable. But if big tech changes its mind, as it very likely will, you'll discover you're building on sand and all of the investors' money goes to hell and the entrepreneur's wasted his time. So unfortunately, the monopolization of big, the internet is sort of reversing the benefits it brought. And also, even just architecturally, I mean, the internet was designed to withstand a nuclear strike and to provide this network we could rely on. Today, a lot of the internet lives inside a few hyperscale data centers, essentially in a few absolutely enormous warehouses owned and operated by big tech. And that's not a very robust architecture either. Anyway, one of the great things about the internet computer, and it brings several new features, is that you can create something called autonomous software that runs as part of the internet. So you can create an internet service that's what we call an open internet service that runs as part of the fabric of the internet. So the idea is that, for example, you might recreate an open version of LinkedIn, and the internet computer provides a functionality that allows you to mark APIs as permanent. So for example, if you created open LinkedIn, which would be controlled by an open governance system, you would mark the API that returns a professional profile as permanent. So there'd be some function that you would share. The function would, take a username and return that user's professional profile. So you'd mark that as permanent. The great advantage of this is that it returns the internet to its roots, that now anybody else can build on top of this data without fear that the rug will be pulled from under them. So you get a kind of, the advantage is you get a kind of mutualized network effect. So today, if you wanted to create an innovative business service that needed to incorporate professional profiles, how would you do it? Well, today you can't do it anyways because LinkedIn's already closed its APIs. But let's say that LinkedIn hadn't already closed its APIs. You could go to a VC, a venture capitalist, and propose your innovative service, and the VC might look at it and go, this is a great idea, Henrik, I really like this, but where are you getting the professional profiles from? And you'd say, I'm getting them from LinkedIn's API, and the VC is going to say to you, hey, Henrik, I love the proposal, I love what you're trying to build, but if we invest in this and LinkedIn decides to revoke your API, then we're going to lose all our money. So your innovative service would never get built. With the internet computer, open LinkedIn can make APIs permanent. Now, all of those thousands of entrepreneurs that want to build new services that need to incorporate professional profiles can go ahead and build those services and propose them to venture capitalists and say, look, there's no chance that the professional profiles we're using are going to get taken away. So you get mutualized network effects. The open LinkedIn can benefit because the functionality is being extended by these thousands of entrepreneurs who aren't afraid that the APIs will disappear. And those other entrepreneurs are now empowered to create new services that that need to incorporate business profiles. So you get mutualized network effects and a much more dynamic and collaborative ecosystem where success depends upon creating the best system, iterating, and creating something people want to use and innovation, as opposed to hijacking people's data. So we think that the internet computer will not only be a cool thing, like it's, the developers of tomorrow will never be able to imagine, signing up for Amazon Web Services, choosing some database, and all of that kind of stuff, because it provides a completely different kind of framework. They're just going to write code and push it directly to the internet to create websites and enterprise systems and internet services. But also, there's going to be a new generation of entrepreneurs that reinvent internet services in open form. So, anything's up for grabs potentially. You know, obviously LinkedIn's an easy one, but what about creating open Salesforce or Twitter or eBay or Airbnb or Uber or eventually, of course, Facebook and even, you know, search.
Now you mentioned both LinkedIn and Facebook because I'm wondering, you need the data. I mean, you need the profiles of people. So if I want to build, for instance, a Danish alternative to Facebook called Danbook, for instance, or Danbook would be in English. How would I go about it with the open internet?
So clearly, without the open internet, you have no chance. Even if you raised $250 million venture capital, it would be impossible to create a new professional profiles network because the network effects of LinkedIn are just too strong. So the open internet will firstly enable you to create an open LinkedIn, which runs as part of the fabric of the internet as autonomous. And just in the same way that, you know, there was a fundamental difference between a petrol, you know, a gas car and an electric car that allowed Tesla to get moving. You know, there's a cohort of people that just want to be driving an electric car and not belching out all the CO2. In the same way, there's a cohort of people that would far rather use an open LinkedIn than closed, proprietary, monopolistic LinkedIn. So that's how you're going to get started. You're going to build your LinkedIn, open LinkedIn. You're going to get that cohort of people into your service. And part of your open LinkedIn is, of course, that you eventually delegate responsibility for updating it and configuring it to a governance system. Another part is that you will, from the beginning, mark APIs as permanent. So, and that's going to be one of your key advantages, because you can now go to other entrepreneurs who are wanting to build open internet services in the business space and say, hey, look, here's an API. It guarantees you access to the professional profiles that are inside open LinkedIn. Why don't you build some other innovative service? And I'll give you an example. So back in Palo Alto, a few years ago, there was a company called RelateIQ. And RelateIQ had this really cool product. They could look at a company's communications and create a wonderful communications graph. So basically, the lines in the graph, the edges, were the communications. So you could hover your mouse and it would say, some of this goes over email, some of this goes over Slack. And the vertices, the points, were people. And you could hover your mouse over the points and up would pop a little profile. And where did the profile come from?
LinkedIn,
of course. That's right. So they actually were doing very successful. I think they got became a unicorn. I think they were worth $1.3 billion at one stage. So they were very successful, and it was a very good company and brilliant team. And then one day, of course, Microsoft bought LinkedIn and revoked their API. And so they ended up selling themselves to Salesforce for about a quarter of their value. Because Salesforce was a big enough player, another fellow big tech, member of the big tech cartel, if you like, and so Microsoft didn't want to turn their API off. And it might sound like that was great for the entrepreneurs, but it wasn't, because you know you have to pay back the VC, so they raised $240 million, so they left $100 million, then they had some smaller share, and then they had to divide that, there were two founders, and then there was tax. And so they ended up with, they created this thing that was worth more than a billion, and they ended up with less than, I'm guessing, 10 or something like that each, 10 million each. So that, you know, that's not a good economic model. And now if you go to downtown Palo Alto, where the fountain is, there used to be a RelateIQ logo, and now there's a Salesforce logo, right? And this is what's happening on the internet today and in Silicon Valley today. And entrepreneurs and venture capitalists are angry because ultimately the internet's being taken back to something like AOL, America Online, right? It's not the internet. So an opportunity for all is disappearing, and it's just being gobbled up. All the value's been gobbled up by these horrible big tech monopolists. So if you created, open LinkedIn, you know, you would have this API, and somebody that wanted to create RelateIQ, or even better, open RelateIQ, could build on top of your API that returned the professional profiles, and they'd never have any worry at all that this would be taken away from them and their service would get broken. So, you know, that means the open RelateIQ can, without any concerns, forward people to open LinkedIn because they can use it like a database, without worrying. And that's originally what people did with LinkedIn, because LinkedIn said, look, here are the APIs, programmable web. Send people here to enter their professional databases, and you can just pull it from the API. Unfortunately, people found out what trusting big tech, where trusting big tech leads you. But that this provides a different way of working.
When will this be possible? I mean, does it work now? Can you use it? Could I build something tomorrow?
Yeah, well, so the project's been going for some time. We've got some of the world's top research scientists and engineers. And we've started at the end of last year pushing technology into the public domain. So we began with an SDK. And this particular SDK has a software language called Motoko, which is designed by some brilliant people, including a guy called Andreas Rosberg, who's the creator of a thing called WebAssembly, who works at Affinity. So this enables you to start developing software that can run on the internet computer and you can test it. We've got other SDKs coming live. We're going to release an incubated version of the internet computer, which is running on Swiss data centers at the moment, just for people to play with this year. But we're hoping that the actual internet computer in beta form will become available to the public after the summer. But all through this year, there are more technology releases. I mean, this has been under development now for some years. So it's obviously a very exciting time that we're able to move towards this. And you know, it's really magical when you see it. I mean, I've been working on this now for years, and you know, I intimately understand the computer science and the architecture and so on. And so, of course, I understand how it works. But even though I spent all these years working so long on it with all these other people, when you actually see it working, it feels like magic, because you realize, hey, of course, like if you can build your website or your enterprise IT system or your internet service directly on the internet without signing up for Google Cloud or Azure or Amazon Web Services, of course, it's got a reimagined framework for software, which is really interesting, and encourage people to go and look at it. Of course, if you don't need a database anymore, why do you want one, right? And of course, this is going to be a great way of building systems, a much better way of building systems, and in the future, people are going to do it this way. But also, I think, for me personally, because, you know, as an early internet enthusiast, seeing how you can reinvent internet services so they run as part of the internet. So rather than just having these private entities hijacking everybody's data and establishing monopolies, we can actually sort of dynamically build out the functionality of the internet in a much more collaborative way. And that these systems will have much better network effects, and that's why they can ultimately beat out these monopolistic closed systems. That's exciting. It's really exciting.
Tektopia. Du har lyttet til Tektopia. Vi udkommer hver eneste uge. Du kan finde links til dagens udsendelse på tektopia.dk. Du kan deltage i teknologidiskussionen i vores Facebook-gruppe Tektopia Backstage, der har 1500 medlemmer, som alle sammen er meget interesserede i teknologi. Godt sted at være og diskutere. Du kan følge med på Twitter på snablagtektopia.dk. Du kan skrive til mig på henriksnablagtektopia.dk. Og så kan du høre vores søsterudsendelse på Radio 4 hver søndag kl. 13.05. Den kommer også som podcast på radio4.dk. Og her kommer der meget snart en udsendelse om det amerikanske søgsmål mod Google og deres monopolistiske stilling på det amerikanske marked, og en gennemgang af nogle af de ting, som de amerikanske politikere har kigget på i forbindelse med de andre tech-giganter. Så hold øje med radio4.dk, og så er der bare tilbage at sige på genhør. Tektopia er en podcast om mennesker og deres teknologi, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Ugeavisen Ingeniøren, med støtte fra Innovation Center Danmark, Messecenter Herning og IDA Forsikring. Mit navn er Henrik Føns, og det er mig, der bestemmer i Tektopia. Tektopia.